You call that radio?
It's season 5, it's episode 6 of You Call That Radio. You join us today from a very sunny day in Glasgow. It's been a very sunny week in Glasgow. But we're going to go back to a rainy January or February where we've been doing a secret project which involves Jim Monin and a panel of special guests called Beyond the Cringe. Jim is our special guest today. Jim is sadly in hospital right now. It's nothing to do with the podcast, by the way. I'd just like to clarify that. I know that Jim is looking forward to listening to this episode, so get well soon, Jim. And I've also put a link to his Ko-fi account if you want to support him. Hopefully he gets well soon and we can get back to recording more episodes. But we already have 4 episodes altogether recorded at Glad Radio at the Deep End. So thanks to them for letting us record there. And he's got some brilliant special guests. So I'm looking forward to releasing these all over the next few weeks. But we thought this is episode 0, basically, of Beyond the Cringe. And it's just me talking to Jim Monin about the concept of Beyond the Cringe and talking about his career as a writer, a poet, and community activist. So we're just going to talk about that and arts and culture in Scotland and stuff like that. It's a really good chat. Thanks to Mako for helping me a little bit of mixing and mastering as well. And I hope you enjoy this. This is just episode 0. And the first proper episode should be out next week. So, yeah, this is Jim Monin, and I hope you enjoy the show. Just one final thing, there's no adverts or sponsors or funding on You Call That Radio. If you want to support, it's completely optional. You go to patreon.com/ You Call That Radio. So there'll be no adverts or sponsors throughout the rest of it. And thanks to everyone who came to our album launch as well. I just want to say it means a lot. We packed out Slay and we're overwhelmed by your generosity and support of the new album from Gyro Babies, which is called Dreams Are Mental. It's not available to stream yet. There's a few singles on the streaming platforms, but the full album's available only on Bandcamp or CD or vinyl. And maybe one day it'll be on the streaming platforms, but for now, that's all the only way you can get it. But just thank you to everyone who came to the show. And thanks to everyone who supports the Patreon. And I really hope you enjoy the start of a new era, which is the Beyond the Cringe era. Get well soon, Jim. This is my interview with Jim Monin.
Beyond the Cringe on You Call That Radio, episode 0.
Hello and welcome to... Well, this is two things. This is almost like a pilot episode of a podcast called Beyond the Cringe. But you also might be listening to it on You Call That Radio, because You Call That Radio is producing Beyond the Cringe, and I'm joined with the host of Beyond the Cringe, Jim Monin. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Mark.
First of all, who are you?
I'm a writer and poet and, I don't know what else it calls, community activist, I think I am, in Govan Hill. And I've been involved in the arts in Scotland, and the admin and promotion side, as well as a practicing artist, for about 40 years now.
And what is... I know you're going to add being a podcaster to your,
yeah,
to your CV.
Yeah, I'm going to try.
Well, you're doing it. You're doing it. It's happening. What is Beyond the Cringe going to be about?
Ah, right. Beyond the Cringe is... There's a lot of stuff about... there's podcasts and other things about Scottish culture. I, rather than do a sort of cultural show, tell you what's on, discuss the best show at the Fringe or anything like that, I wanted to do a series of podcasts about the whole nature of Scottish culture. What is it? What do we call Scottish culture? What do we recognise as Scottish culture? Is it particularly Scottish? Is it any good? Is it worth celebrating as a Scottish culture? Or are we just the same as anywhere else?
And do you have an opinion on that? Do you want to share your opinion on that?
I kind of have a... Overall, I kind of think we are the same as anywhere else, in that do you know, so probably our most popular Scottish music as, you know, people at Teenage Fan Club and all that kind of stuff are heavily influenced by, sort of, it's American rather than Scottish sort of influence. Simple Minds, there's a current documentary about Simple Minds, people looking back at them, huge, massive, internationally known band. It's probably very European sounding rather than Scottish, if you like. So I kind of think that we're part of a wider world culture, and some things, and sometimes in Scotland we're good at certain things, but it's not necessarily, that doesn't necessarily make it a Scottish culture, if you know what I mean. It just makes it culture that happens to be happening in Scotland at that time.
How long have you been in that, did you say there, sorry?
About 40 years, I think. 40 years. I'd say, in fact, more than that. I think the first time I'd actually organised a gig or anything, maybe about 1979, 80, something like that.
Tell us about the first gig.
First gig? There was two or three, I'm trying to think what was the first one. First one, Church Hall in Galston. St. Sophia's, Church Hall, a band called the Badger Sisters. And trying to think who else were on. Expelled, who's Davey Wiseman for the Fearties, for Junkman's Choir, one of his first bands, and The Hut, a band for Galston, and me doing some poems in between.
Legend, he's a legend as well.
There's about eight people there, it's great.
So how does it feel when you put on your own gig, there's eight people turn up? Were you happy with that?
At that time it didn't matter, it was punk, we were just happy to be able to make noise in the church hall, and we were just doing it for each other, really. There was other times where it was mobbed and huge. By the time it got to the 80s, I was doing it professionally. And I had a weekly club in Kilmarnock, and we were putting on the Shaman and Primal Scream and all those bands at the time. And by that stage, yeah, I'm no happy if we don't sell tickets, because it's actually cost me money. Back in the day, it didn't really matter, you know. Nobody was getting paid, nobody was caring. We were just happy to be able to make some noise, you know.
Could you tell back then that Primal Scream were going to be as big as they were? Did you have an inkling?
No, really, no. I think they've been gone for a couple of years. Primal Scream at that stage, it was a kind of time of Imperial and all that was before. Like a lot of bands, like the Shaman, when I put the Shaman on, they sounded a bit like the Doors or the Stranglers or something. Didn't they sound like the way they end? So it was pre-Ecstasy. It was before the indie bands took Ecstasy and got funky, and so Primal Scream were good that night. I really liked them. I was into that kind of scene at the time anyway. But it was like 80 people in Kilmarnock on a Thursday night. You know, I think I paid them £120.
So you said the Shaman there as well. I absolutely love the Shaman. I'm trying to imagine the Shaman like pre rave generation Shaman. So you're saying it's like the Doors. Mr. C singing.
You know that's going to sound like the Doors, the Stranglers are a bit like that. There's a keyboard.
Yeah, got you.
It's quite dark and all that. There's an album called The Drop, or just Drop, just before the famous Shaman. And it's really good, actually, really good stuff.
Just going back to the sort of theme of Beyond the Cringe, when you're doing these gigs, do you feel that you're part of Scottish culture at this point, or part of Ayrshire culture?
See, that's the thing, you know. So I do. I'm Scottish, you know. So I'm part of, or have been part of, various scenes, whether it's poetry scene, literary scene, whatever, in Scotland. But I am also, Ayrshire. I'm very much a East Ayrshire, a Cumnock person. I see myself part of mining culture, and things like that. You know, I see this as part of my culture, and also I lived in London for many years. But I kind of think it's probably around the time of the 2014 referendum thing, and that year there was National Collective, and there was loads of talk about Scottish culture, and it didn't seem to me as if anybody was asking the question about, well, what is it? What is it, the Scottish culture you're talking about? You know, they would just talk about like a whole load of general things that happened in Scotland, and, you know, some of them were being done by people who weren't Scottish in Scotland, so we're claiming all the non-Scots doing stuff, and we were claiming all the Scottish people who did something abroad, you know what I mean?
It's kind of like the way that...
So average white band weren't the American culture, they were Scottish culture, because they were born in Scotland, but whereas anybody who's moved here from somewhere else, and is now
ACDC.
ACDC is Scottish culture.
Yeah, it's everything.
And so is somebody born elsewhere who's now making records in Scotland, Lloyd Cole or whatever.
Well, it seems to be quite a common. I mean, I know the London media likes to do that. If you lose a sporting event, you're Scottish, and if you win, you're British.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's British culture if you're a winner.
Mm.
But if you lose, you're Scottish.
And just a sporting event, what we will be doing is, when I talk about Scottish culture, we'll be talking about it in its widest sense. So culture to me includes FITBA, includes media, includes things like that. So it includes languages, so it includes the wit. So we're looking at culture in a widest sense. I might even do an episode on religion, but...
Good luck with that.
Could be dangerous.
So, what do you have plans? Do you have concepts of a plan?
Yeah, initially what we're going to do is, each episode we'll look at a different subject, so subject by subject, and the first one will be Scottish music. It's a nice easy one to get into because everybody's got an opinion, and there's loads of people, loads of good guests you can get on. For the music issue episode, we have Grant McPhee, who's the writer and filmmaker. He made the Teenage Superstars film, New Gold Dreams as well. He's currently got a book, Postcards from Scotland, about postcard records, orange juice and a stick camera, etc. We've got Carla Easton, singer-songwriter, lead singer of the Teen Canteen, and also she's recently made a film since yesterday about the history of girl bands in Scotland. And Josie Long, who is a comedian, lives in Glasgow, from London, but she's also a big, long-term fan of Scottish music, Scottish indie music specifically.
That's a cracking lineup, I guess, for the first episode, so that's going to focus on music. And what do you have other subjects already in mind?
Yeah, I think the first three, I think, are going to be music, FITBA, unfortunately, and Scottish television. I think that's the three that's going to be, but in the future, following on for that, definitely Scottish theatre, books, possibly religion, and I definitely want to look at languages, but I don't know how to do the languages thing, because I'd have to do it in English, because I don't speak any languages.
But well, I tell you, the best guest I ever had on that was probably Dr. Michael Dempster.
On Scots language stuff?
Yes, on the Scots language.
Yeah, Michael Dempster.
I learned so much talking to him.
Absolutely. Michael Dempster, Billy Kay and others are really good on the Rob Wilson on the Scottish language stuff, especially the Lallan Scots, which I was brought up with. In Cumnock, I don't really speak it now. I speak a dialect.
Did you feel sick at 7:30?
Aye. Really, all of that. My gran had different words for everything, absolutely everything. Like a tap was a spigot. Shoes were shin. Slippers were hoose shin. All that kind of stuff. Eyes were ees and een for een. Two eyes.
Just going back to slippers, why are Fife people so obsessed with Baffies?
Yeah, they call them Baffies, don't they?
They call them Baffies, but that's not the problem, because obviously every part of Scotland's got different words they use. But I feel that the people of Fife, I love the people of Fife, can I just clarify? But they do talk about Baffies a lot. Like, it just seems to come up in conversation. Like, in Glasgow, they don't have many conversations about slippers. But I'm just wondering, in Ayrshire, what did you say that you called your...
Hooshin, like shoes for the house.
Hooshin.
Hooshin.
Right, I've never heard that one, and I represent Ayrshire myself, but maybe I've had a different time.
That's a thing, though. We've had this conversation before about Ayrshire. Ayrshire's huge.
It's a big place.
It's massive.
And you're in deepest, darkest Ayrshire as well.
People do think that if you know somebody, if you're from Ayrshire, I know somebody from Ayrshire, do you know them? And you think, well, that's like 50 miles away from me. You know what I mean? I don't know them.
There's just one bus stop called Ayrshire.
Aye, so I'm from sort of south-east Ayrshire, right in the border of Dumfriesshire, and Mark's from sort of north-west, right in the border of, like, Inverclyde kind of thing, type of thing.
No, I know Inverclyde, no, or but it's Renfrewshire. Like, I'm kind of like, no, well, I suppose it's no far, it's kind of like, I'm halfway between sort of Glasgow and Ayr, so if, that's what
I thought you were Cowinning, were you not Cowinning?
Irvine, then Cowinning. So like from a train's perspective or a driving perspective, it's just probably quicker for me to go to Glasgow than it is to go to Ayr.
Aye.
And that's why when people ask me about Ayr nightclubs, it's like, nobody went to Ayr nightclubs. Because obviously I was just too young to catch the rave culture scene the first time round with the Metro and Hangar 13. And Ayrshire was one of the most important parts of rave culture. People used to travel from London and or all around the world.
Absolutely,
to go to the Metro or Hangar 13.
Or even big one-off events at Prestwick Airport and things.
Yeah, well,
I remember, was it monthly
nights at Prestwick Airport?
There was one in Newcombe years ago that had, like, Public Enemy and all that there. It was mental. Earthquaker or something, I think it was called.
But with the Ayrshire, we didn't talk about slippers much. I don't remember talking about slippers much.
No. I don't know if we could afford... Maybe, I don't know. I don't know if I had slippers, to be honest. But I remember my grand called them Hooshin. Maybe there's a thing in Fife where... I know loads of Turkish people who, they like, so definitely shoes off the minute you get in the house, and they've got what they call patek, little knitted slippers. And you go in the house, you take off your shoes, you put on your pateks.
You know? It just seems like it's like, oh, you know, you see what bands like Root System, great band, they were like, oh, we're on early, we're on at 10 o'clock, so you'll be, hey, me, your baffies on by midnight. You know, it just seems to be just turn up in conversations. Anyway, I'm getting derailed by slipper, the Fife slipper conversation again.
Maybe we should have a whole episode on
just
on
a whole episode in Fife slippers. What I found quite interesting is that, well, you mentioned Josie Long there, so that's somebody who's moved to Glasgow. What do you just as a general question, how do you think Scottish culture is perceived outside of Scotland?
That's an interesting one I want to try and get people on the show to talk about. So it'll not just be Scottish people on. When we're talking about football, I've got Terry Christian coming on, used to present the word and all that. So it's kind of, I've got, I want to hear what people think. I don't know what people think of Scotland. I think there's a tendency for Scottish things not to be seen as Scottish, if you know what I mean. So if you're in America and you like certain Scottish bands, they're just bands that you like. If somebody asks you about Scotland, you probably will imagine a drunk guy on EastEnders or something like that, or some kind of mad serial killer or something like that. And so I kind of think there's an issue. There's an image of Scotland and Scottish, and then there's a different thing about Scottish culture, because you have Scottish culture musically. I mean, some of the periods of Scottish music have been absolutely immense worldwide. So you get, like, bands in Seattle, and Nirvana and all that sitting... Like playing cover versions, sitting at home, completely like engrossed in the music of bands for Bells Hill, that only sell 500 records, but one of the biggest bands ever, Nirvana, are brought up listening to their music. So you get that right across the world. The same when it was Postcard Records, where it was like Aztec Camera and Orange Juice. Go Betweens were Australian band, but they were on Postcard Records. Globally, it was seen as a kind of phenomenon. Even in sort of rave thing, you know, that I know loads of guys for England too, just thought that whole Scottish TTF stuff and all that was like the peak, was the pinnacle of it and all that. So you kind of, but I don't know if they look at that and say, oh, I like Scottish music, or just that I like indie music, and some of the bands I like tend to be Scottish type of thing, you know.
That's a really good point, because, you know, if you're in a band and you're thinking about tagging, how they describe this, and you're in, you know, if you're a DJ, if you're doing techno, or even if you're doing guitar music, post-punk or something, does the tag Scottish music cover it, or does the word Scottish music conjure up images of bagpipes and kilts?
Well, see, that is a Scottish culture, and there is a Scottish music scene.
Well, that's the end of the podcast then, so there is Scottish culture.
That is Scottish, I didn't say that Scottish culture.
Right, aye.
So, there is an obvious Scottish music, and there's an obvious Scottish music scene who release records. There's Scottish country dancing, there's traditional Scottish music, there's bagpipe music, there's all of that is Scottish.
I think Scottish hip-hop's also Scottish, right, because of the accent is so Scottish.
Yeah. But the culture of Scotland itself, what makes up a country, a nation, is a whole load of different things. And I would say that in terms of importance of how people live their life and the culture they live in, they will live in a popular culture, and you're more likely to be listening to Teenage Fan Club than you are to Jimmy Shand, if you know what I mean.
So I see with the point you're saying. So obviously Bell and Sebastian had some success over there as well, but do you not think people are seeing them? Do you think that someone in America is seeing someone like Bell and Sebastian as a a great band from the UK?
I think so, yeah. I used to manage a band called...
Or Europe, even.
Yeah,
a
yeah.
A good European
Europe,
yeah. band.
But I think UK, I think Britain's got a kind of an identity and image when it comes to music. I used to manage a band called Trash Can Sinatra, so a Scottish band. When we were in America, touring in America, people saw them very much as... they were all looking for a new Smiths at the time. But it saw them very much in the vein of a band called XTC. So they had this kind of, what they would call college music, like indie music or alternative music, with college radio stations. And the Trash Cans, being for Irvine, sang even in a Scottish accent, would have been seen in the same vein as the Smiths and XTC, rather than in the same vein as Scottish country dance or bagpipe music, if you know what I mean.
It's interesting because obviously this predates the internet. So I didn't, and obviously Trash Can Sinatra were obviously happening. They were touring America.
And touring America just as the internet started.
Yeah.
In 1990.
Well, I didn't have the internet for a long time, until after.
Nobody did.
Yes.
When I say, I think I started between those two guys.
Yeah. So I suppose back then as well, it was about how the media portrayed this. So were things like, were the newspapers, were the tabloids supportive of Trash Can Sinatra's? Were they mainstream enough? Did you get some?
Oh, right. I mean, with Trash Cans, it was a kind of... there's a brilliant podcast documentary to listen to right now by Ken Sweeney. An Irish guy's made a documentary about Trash Cans. Really worth listening to. Goes into all their history. And also, there's a brilliant one by Davy Scott. It does classic Scottish albums on a BBC podcast, looking at their, I think, fourth album, Weightlifting. But if you go back to when I was involved with the Trash Cans, we were sometimes portrayed as Scottish, you know, in America. And I think that was to do with, if you kind of, there's parts of America that are more Scottish than others. So it might be something that appealed to the people for that certain area or whatever. There are parts of America that are very Scottish, if you like. But in terms of the mainstream media in Scotland, very, very, very supportive. In fact, still, a lot of the people are still writing, Billy Sloan and all that kind of stuff, very much so. BBC Radio Scotland, STV, BBC, the Daily Record had them single of the year, album of the year, I think. And so you had very much support there. In England, less so. It was the kind of time just at the start of what became Britpop and all that stuff. So it was a lot of guitar bands, so it was a lot of competition, you know.
So, yeah, they just missed the Britpop boat.
Aye, just before it.
Just predated it.
Or maybe around about the same time as it, but weren't they Brit
enough? And how did English media portray them? Because we talked about how, some depending on where you were in America, how did England make a deal with them being a Scottish band? Or is it just another UK band?
I do remember, actually, a particular review of a single saying that they were inheritors of Deacon Blues' crown of the kings of brush-swept Scottish pop, right? I always remember everybody would be dead angry, including Deacon Blue, because nobody knew what the hell that meant or anything like that. But it's no what the Trash Cans, didn't see themselves as in the same vein as Deacon Blue or anything like it. But I think it's because they're Scottish, then looking into Scotland, you can see these bands have been similar just because they're Scottish, even though they're probably nothing like each other, you know, so, yeah.
It's quite a common trope that the English media, which I've noticed a lot less of now, but I remember when my band was starting it, and I've just seen it in general, everyone getting described as the Proclaimers with...
Absolutely.
They just throw in because...
The Proclaimers on acid.
The Proclaimers on acid, yes. The Proclaimers having a house party with...
The Proclaimers with English accents. Right, yeah, very much so.
Sometimes it was meant as a, and also it's obviously not throwing shade at the Proclaimers at all, but sometimes it's meant as a, I feel like it's meant as a sort of an insult, depending on the music. Sometimes it's meant as a compliment.
Aye.
And it's quite hard to figure out too, unless you're looking the person dead in the eye.
But I mean, the thing about Proclaimers I've always kind of thought is that because they do sing in a particular, is it Fife or Fife?
Yeah.
I think Fife accents. There's quite strong accents, then people see that as the thing about the Proclaimers. They're actually really, really quality songwriters, these guys. Me and Becky Wallace went to see them last year at the Academy, and you forget until you see them live that every song's an absolute belter. And I remember having their first album, and I put them on at that club in Kilmarnock. It was packed out. It was my best gig ever. It was the first time I ever made real money. And they sent me a copy of the album. I think I was meant to give it away to the local paper, a surprise. So I just kept it and played it, and I played it a lot. Quality of the songwriting was absolutely brilliant. And sometimes I think people forget that about the Proclaimers. They like to talk about it. So if you do something in a Scottish accent, and particularly a Scottish way, people will talk about the Scottishness of it rather than the quality of the work, you know?
There's, if no doubt, phenomenal songwriters. And I suppose they're actually a really good band to bring up in this conversation, because what you've got there is that they are overtly Scottish, but they did something modern with it for its time. So now they kind of set the bar. So that's why anybody who's, whether it's, you know, whether it's rap music or it's grunge music, if you've got an overtly Scottish accent, then the Proclaimers could very well pop into the description.
Yeah,
somehow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How were the Proclaimers perceived at that time? Because obviously, I just grew up, so I remember being a wee guy.
So the album came out, I think, in 87, I think it was.
And it mentioned Irvine No More, so obviously as a kid.
Bathgate, Linwood, all that stuff. And but you've got, it came out, I think it was 87 that album came out. And it was, there was two things going on. There was people kind of seeing them as a bit of a novelty act. And obviously, but that is disproved in the fact that they're still there. You know, had they been famous for 6 months,
touring the world, playing massive festivals.
But they had a lot of backing for people, for a record company and all that. There was people like Paul Heaton and the House Martins and people like that who...
Absolute legend.
Were big fans of them and all that stuff. So there's a lot of songwriters out there saw that these guys were quality songwriters, first and foremost.
So Paul Heaton's always been on the right side of history?
I think Paul took them on tour, actually.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
At that time.
Gave us our first radio play as well with Mr. Heaton.
Did he? Yeah.
Sure.
He's a top bloke. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a good guy. So, would you say that the arts in Scotland, the Scottish culture in general, from all years, because obviously, like I said, that I was the Proclaimers have always existed, really, for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just take them as they are. And what would you say that the arts in Scotland is getting better? Worse? Is it staying the same?
That is, you see, that's a thing that I want to explore. I don't know, so I want to explore that with my guests over the episodes, because I think there is a tendency for people of a certain age to have, you know, your peak was when, the best times is when you were a teenager and you were first into music. So to me, there'll never be albums that will top the albums that came out in the late 70s, the punk albums. There'll never be albums that will top that. But if I had to sit down and think of what's my favourite album and what album I'm going to play all the time, it probably isn't one of them, you know. So it probably does top it, but I have a thing in my heart for the punk rock and reggae music that happened in the late 70s, and everybody will have their peak. So I think in Scottish culture, there will be several kind of peaks and things like that, that people, and it would depend on your background, class, age, etc. And as to how you see that. So for instance, I know you've been heavily involved in Scottish hip-hop. I don't know much about Scottish hip-hop other than the people I know, because I've come across them through other work and through doing gigs.
There's definitely an overlap sometimes with the poetry scene, so that I think that's how you know.
Yeah, that's how I'd get to know them. And so I don't know, I couldn't say to anybody whether Scottish hip-hop is of a standard as good as Norwegian or Glasgow or London hip-hop or anything like that. I have no idea, because
some of them,
I don't have any to compare it to or anything.
Some of them are.
But I think there'll be some people who will think that, you know, Postcard Records, whatever, is the peak, and Scottish music will never get any better. You know what I mean?
It could be
that right now the best Scottish band ever is playing right under our noses and none of us know them, you know?
You mentioned Scottish hip-hop there. I think that since the podcast is called Beyond the Cringe, I think there's no genre that's best explained by that word, because I feel like if you sing in a Scottish accent, folk music, trad, it's the world loves it. If you tell comedians when they tell jokes in a Scottish accent, it's accepted, probably thanks to Billy Connolly and Kevin Bridges, Frankie Boyle, people like that. But for some reason, if you put, or a poet, poetry, Scottish poets, we've got Robbie Burns, the original.
Heard of him.
You heard of him. Ayrshire, good Ayrshire boy. And so when people do poetry in Scots, it sounds like it's meant to be. But then you put a really well-produced banging beat behind it, and people cringe.
Aye. No, I get that, because there is a... Hip-hop's an American culture. It's an American art form that came over here. I mean, it took over everything. At one point, if you look at the charts...
Is it American culture, though? I thought you just said that culture's just culture. That's culture that happens in America.
Right, you're right. I mean, it's not American culture, but it's an American art form. Like jazz, it started in America and came over here. So people got used to hearing it in a certain way. And a lot of British hip-hop, very early on, were doing it in American accents. Just like over here, when rock and roll and that type of music first came over here, all of the British bands were singing in American accents. And so I get that it might clash with certain people, and they've got used to that London in it. I think there is a certain criticism of Scottish hip-hop in terms of the accent. It's just people who are biased against that accent. Darren McGarvey's had a lot. I've seen loads of comments on social media, people going, I just speak English, what the hell are you talking about, and all that kind of stuff, rather than Darren's telling his story in his language, you know.
Well, hip-hop for me has got to be authentic, so if you're putting on an accent, it doesn't work for me.
Aye,
but some people do it. I've noticed there's some younger guys are doing it again, and they're putting on the American accent, which means they might be successful, you know.
Yeah.
It's a very niche thing.
I mean, I think... You do what you think. You do what you think's right for you and your art. You know, there's no really. I don't do my poems in Scots. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I've got little bits of Scots. So, the actual Scots language, I don't speak. What I do is my poems come out in a Scots dialect of the English language, which is different from Scots. You know, which is a language in its own. And so I kind of I don't do it deliberately or choose to do it. That's just the way it comes out. And if you've got, for instance, I mentioned before, Teenage Fan Club, very American sounding band, nothing wrong with that, you know what I mean? That's their genre, that's their music, you know?
Yeah. Also, as a poet, the good thing about being, I suppose, multilingual, in a way, is that you'll be as Scottish as the words in front of you. So sometimes saying tay instead of two,
yeah,
it's going to rhyme better in Scots, and sometimes it's going to rhyme better in the Queen's English.
Aye.
So it's going back to the point you're saying. So it was quite good that you avoided that question, because I think that was the right way to do it. Is culture getting better or worse? Because we are all biased to our own.
Absolutely, and I do think that there's a thing that everybody does, and it's not Scottish. It's everywhere. That kind of thing where your parents will say, "What's that you're listening to? That's terrible. That's just noise."
Yes.
And then there's a danger that we all start doing that later on with the new music that's coming through.
I found myself doing it recently for the first time ever since post-lockdown, just thinking about how things have changed. And, you know, there's obviously there's a lot of venues suffering, bands suffering. There's just not really any money in the industry just now in the arts. So I feel I've been quite negative about it all, because things aren't the same, they're not the way they used to be. Then every so often I'll go to a gig, and it's like the young people don't know that. They're just still having packing out small venues and having the time of their life, and they're having their moment. So I'm going to check myself in that, and obviously we're still going to demand that the arts gets more funding. It needs more funding. We need more help for venues and bars. But let's not talk it down so much. The scene, like, you know, as if, because festivals are struggling, and I just feel like I've been guilty of it as well, as just saying, our music festivals, use them or lose them. And I don't think that's a very positive way to promote these events. I don't think that's very enticing to a buyer, or we better use it or lose it.
Yeah. And I do think that sometimes there's stuff happening under the radar that we're unaware of. And these people they'll not even care about Creative Scotland funding, or they won't even see themselves part of the art scene, and people will be going, and it's especially young people, because I always remember that like all those great bands of the punky that I was brought up with, they were basically, when the Jam were on Top of the Pops, Paul Weller was like 18, 17, something like that. You know, they were young, and I was 15. You're listening to those bands, and you're even younger. And that's the crucial bit, because that's pop music, that's the important audience, I think. And sometimes you forget that at Govan Hill Festival last year, after the parade, Love Music Hate Racism did a little thing. There was local drill, it might be Rangier, but it's a hip-hoppy type thing. Drill. Yeah. There's a local band who are guys that just work in the vape shop in Vicky Road, and they've got massive following. I think they're called something like the Triple O's or the Triple O Zeros or something.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yep. It's real.
They performed up in the park, and all of a sudden, right, the whole audience changed. All of a sudden, all the families and the people who are out in Govan Hill, are normally out in Govan Hill, a whole, like, 200 young kids, all wearing black, pulled into Queen's Park, watched that band, went mental, started fighting each other, and then all paraded in Vicky Road at the same time, making everybody scared. They're seen, everybody's looking at them going, who the hell are they? They're local kids that live here and love this thing that we weren't even aware of, that's probably selling more tickets than all the things that we think's the great things around here, you know?
Well, obviously, my band has never had any funding at all, nothing like that, but I do worry that it is getting harder and harder for young, you know, to start, because right now, if you've got people are working two jobs to pay the rent, where do you find time and money to go into the studio and rehearse and record?
I think there's two things there, Mark.
Or to go to an open mic night and buy pints. You know, where does that extra time and money come from?
I think there's two things there. You're right. There isn't this opportunities and funding. Back in the day, part of what councils would do, and part of what the Arts Council, which became Creative Scotland, would do, was create local facilities. So I worked for a while in an old school that was converted into a rehearsal room where just a four-track studio in it. There was guys like, you know, the hip-hop band for Ayrshire, All Time High?
Yes.
They worked in it. There was a studio that was paid for by the council up in, I think, a Drawson or something like that kind of stuff, that they did a lot of stuff in.
Stevenson.
Helping young people and all that as well. So you had your opportunities. But although those things are not there in the same way now, the ones that are left are a few commercial studios rather than council-backed ones who need to make money to pay their rent and all that. There is opportunities that my generation didn't have in terms of you can make a video with your phone, do you know what I mean, that we can't do. You can have a concert online that we can't do. Like Boiler Room have things where there's only 30 people at a gig, but there's 3,000 people dancing in the living rooms and things like that kind of stuff, you know.
Well, Boiler Room's actually 3,000 people and paying their DJs £200,
aye. So you have that kind of concept where the technology of today means that it's maybe not as much of a barrier as I think it is. I would say to myself, oh, it's no fair that young people don't have this same opportunity to get into a studio and record for free. But to a young person involved in drill, they might think, what? Studio? What? What do you mean studio? I've got a bedroom.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, so there is that. The technology kind of maybe weighs things, sort of balances things out a little bit. I suppose you could make that argument. I'm not sure about that.
Aye, me neither. It's just because I don't know, because I'm old. So I'd need to ask somebody, a young person, who.
Well, I think the problem with the technology is that although it is a big advantage, is that it's the saturation of content. Music's now competing for people's attention in a way.
Absolutely.
So it's like, you know, people used to spend £15 on a CD and just listen to it.
And that, to get back to your question, that's the thing about things being worse or better and all that stuff. There's a real danger that when resources are low, that the scrap and the fight for the resources lowers the quality, because all we're interested in is getting the thing that will sell the ticket. Because if we don't sell the ticket, we won't get the follow-up funding, and therefore, and so it can water stuff down. So a theatre could put on a less interesting season of plays because they think, oh my God, if I don't do the numbers, I'll put on the steamy again because I know I'll always sell tickets. That type of thing, you could end up with. That means that when the steamy's on for a month, some young playwright who's running a play is no getting a space because an old play's going back on just for safety's sake. Same with venues, programming might look at, you know, oh, there's an interesting young band, but rather than take the risk, I'll put on Colonel Mustard or the Gyro Babies because I know a few hundred people are going to come to that, guaranteed. So there is a kind of, when resources are low and we're scrapping for the resources, there's a danger that it affects all the art forms because we're fighting for every quid.
Yeah, and I suppose it's the short-term culture, short-form culture,
yeah,
I suppose, another way to look at it, because that is what people are eating up just now. They're not watching, as far as I'm aware, I've seen some studies on it. But some of it's not official, but the attention span,
yeah,
and the ability to just, you know, who is listening to an album from start to finish. People, I can be guilty of it as well, listen to an album once, pick out your favourite songs and add it to your bigger playlist. People scrolling through it and, you know, you see a video and it's only 60 seconds or 3 minutes, you watch it, are you going to watch a 60 minute documentary on YouTube when you can watch a 60 second recap?
Absolutely. I never play records or CDs anymore. I don't own records anymore. But I went the opposite way. I got rid of all my vinyl when I moved up. I moved flat about 12 years ago, and all the vinyl, I just gave it away and to people that wanted it more than me, because I just never played it. And then, same with CDs and that, eventually I gave them away. I gave loads of books and stuff away, because they were just things in my flat. And I find that if I want to listen to a song, I'll get it on YouTube or Spotify or something and I'll listen to it. I don't really need it to be... I'm not a kind of person that needs some big sound system back now. I'm quite happy with just my headphones on. And I don't need to own it to hear it, if you know what I mean. So there's very little that I can watch or read or listen to.
No, that's another disadvantage that the young bands are up against, because people aren't buying the vinyl. They're not buying it,
so I'm not contributing money.
And Spotify is paying 0.0004 pence per stream.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, so the difference, if you're buying the vinyl, the band's ending up with like £4 instead of 0.004 pence, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Buy the digital download, and it's on Bandcamp's a lot better. So yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to move on to the... I've got a couple of notes here. I've not even looked at my notes yet, because I was wanting to ask you about stuff. Do you remember writing your first poem?
I and it was there. My first poems, like a lot of poets, were lyrics to songs to bands that like barely existed and flopped badly, songs that never really went anywhere, and so became my first poems. So I can remember writing them. Me and a guy called Liam Lynch had a band, and a kind of post-punk kind of guitar band. I was the singer and the lyricist, and I wrote really quite cringy political things that, you know, leftist writing and right is wrong.
Have I done that?
Yeah. All the things that everybody wrote when they were that age and all that stuff.
The equivalent of Scottish hip hop's the lyric, yeah. Rhyming lyrical and miracle.
Yeah, and four of them ended up in a poetry compilation called Water Closets, which was put out through record shops and Rough Trade and all that kind of stuff in 1980. So four of them are still about somewhere. I don't know if Andy's still got a copy of that thing. It was a kind of zine type thing. But it was, I look back and I'm quite embarrassed with them, to be honest.
Where are they?
Dig them out. No, there's
some. The next episode. What's called? We'll be on the cringe. If it makes you cringe, then you've got to go beyond that.
I know.
Do you know? Look it back. I cringe when I can't watch a live performance or even listen to a podcast or anything I've done for about a year or maybe 2 years. But then when I look back, I don't cringe anymore. I go, good on the wee man. Good on the wee guy. I've got better since then. I can justify it. It's a different person.
I think the difference with me, Mark, is it's 40 odd years ago, so it's a massive difference. And it's not only that.
But do you not think, good on you?
I never really saw myself seriously as a poet until I've had sort of three goes at being a poet, and it's the third one, the most recent one, which is the last 20 years, which is different from when I did it before, which was basically just song lyrics that didn't have a song, so they became poetry, and they weren't really poems as such. So I kind of, I am so cringed about them that I would never. There's no way I'm digging them out even for a laugh.
Do it for charity. You've got to dig them out somehow.
No, there's no chance that I'll ever have. No. And I also had a spell where I'd go to Celtic games in the 1980s. We travelled everywhere to see Celtic, and I was a Celtic poet on the supporters bus.
I'm sure I can believe that.
Pubs before games and all that. I'd get up on a table and do some really ranty anti-Rangers poem and. Just to play to the audience, and the place would go mental and all that stuff, and they were awful. I mean, I look back and I can think of some of them I can still remember off by heart. But they were awful.
If you want to perform,
they're the kind of things that if I heard somebody doing, I'd probably give that guy a kicking.
Aye,
that's how bad they were. And they were deliberately sectarian, deliberately meant to get the audience going and all that. Felt good at the time, so some of them are just. I'm no digging in.
Right, okay, fair enough.
There will never be a retrospective release of the Basement Tapes.
Fair enough. But maybe not your sectarian era, but more about your.
This current era, if you like, it comes down to a poem you know well called "The United Colours of Cumnock."
Yeah,
and I wrote a lot of poetry at that time, and there was a particular poem that I wrote about my hometown. That just weirdly just fell out of me. I take a long time to write a poem. This one was written in a couple of days, and for ages I sat on it because I thought, God, this seems it's so fucking good. That it's, I'm allowed to swear, and so
you
good.
Swear. It's your podcast. You can do what you want.
It feels familiar though. It feels like I must have nicked this idea. I was terrified to kind of say it or do it because I thought. It was all so easy that I think I've probably stolen this idea, inadvertently stolen it from somewhere else. So it took me ages of getting people to listen to it, talk to people and say, have you heard this before? My town is a blue town, my town is a green town. And convinced that somebody was going to tell me that I stole it.
Do you want, well, could you perform that for us then? Go beyond the cringe and give us our first live performance.
Oh, right. I wasn't expecting.
I feel like if you're going to, rather than talk about, we don't need a guitar.
Well, I do have a poem that's actually particularly about the Scottish cringe and about the subject of the thing about Scottish culture and all that. Rather than United Colours of Cumnock, I think.
Just do both, and we can edit it if we need to.
Okay, right. United Colours of Cumnock. I wrote this about my hometown at the time, and a place I was born in and spent half my life in on and off over the years. I moved away when I was 5, and I moved back when I was 27 or something, brought my son up there. But it is my hometown, Cumnock. My town is a green town, but it's not like a fuck the queen green town. It's a tree in every scene town with Gairdens freshly dug. That's green that pours through every crack, through pavements, viaducts, FITBA parks, where men who suffer heart attacks go walks with three-leg dogs. My town is a blue town. A who the fuck are you town? What school did you go to town, and are you one of us? That's blue that seeps through doors and walls, for pubs and bookies, village halls, where men would guard old Derry's walls instead of guarding us. My town was once a red town, another minor dead town, a men who fought and bled town with brave and stalwart wives. That's red that came from meeting rooms, for folk that worked the pumps and looms when borough bands played different tunes and we marched for better lives. But now my town's a grey town, a 50 mils a day town, a watch life slip away town, a tunnel wany light. That's grey that weeps for dying eyes, bewildered parents, children's cries with skinny arms and stick-like thighs, and nae strength left to fight. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Brilliant stuff.
This poem, Jock Tamson Gurns, is about the nature of the Scottish cultural cringe. I suspect there's probably a Korean cringe and a Mexican cringe and every other kind of cringe. And it's about looking at Scottish culture from the outside looking in, I suppose.
Can I just interrupt that? So you're saying that every other place has the cringe?
I think so. I think there's just I don't know if we even have it, you know. I kind of think that we're much the same as anywhere else.
But we do have it, though. I mean, when the Scottish guy comes on EastEnders, people do have the Scottish cringe.
Yeah,
but it's because they put on a kind of weird accent. Like,
yeah, I know, but I'm sure if a German guy comes on EastEnders, the Germans will go, God, look at him, he's not even funny, they've got no sense of humour.
All right, interesting. I don't know if you're right, I'll have a think about it.
Aye.
Right, sorry.
I mean, we'll talk about it over in the podcast.
Yeah, I know, it's worth it. I would like to actually ask.
Aye. Other so, people. Jock Thompson Gardens.
Go for it.
Scottish fitters in the dock, it seems that we're a laughing stock of Europe. No longer will we see the day when the likes of Cooper, Hansen, Paul McStay, Baxter, Johnson, Dennis Law, the artists or the Tanner Ball, will grace the greatest stage on earth and show the world what we are worth. But as our team face many tankings and slip further down the FIFA rankings, maybe we should ponder whether this list of heroes even ever played together. I mean, it was the McNeil that lifted up the 1966 World Cup. 4 years later, we didn't even go to the classic finals in Mexico. But then I'm sure that David Hume did not meet Irvin Welsh or Walter Scott. James McMillan never will debate with Pien. But it's the same for Poland and for Sweden. For Marie Curie never got a call for Copernicus or Pope John Paul. So although we like to greet and whinge and exercise the Scottish cringe, let's face it, just like many nations, we sometimes rise above our station. So don't mope when it doesn't go our way. Rejoice when the wee dug has its day. We've aye been mediocre. We've never been great. But let's enjoy and celebrate the times, the beautiful times, when we punch above our weight.
Nice one. So did Scott, probably the last thing I want to ask you is, did Scotland invent everything? Or are we deluding ourselves?
No, we're fucking totally deluding ourselves. We a lot of things have been invented, but there's enough to fill a tea towel. But I mean, things like, for instance, Alexander Fleming from Ayrshire discovered penicillin. He discovered penicillin while working for an English hospital in London. You know, I mean, that's where he discovered penicillin. Marconi and all those things, like. It was Italian, but he owned his place in Scotland, so we call it Scottish. Alexander Graham Bell invented a phone, maybe. But if he did it in America, working with an American firm, not in Scotland. So I sometimes Scottish people...
So Daily Record Scottish rather than...
Aye, sometimes Scottish people...
And this is, so that kind of rounds back to the start of what we were saying, that when they win, they're Scottish, and when they don't, don't know.
Aye. Can I finish with a wee Frankie Boyle thing that Frankie Boyle once said?
Yeah.
That John Logie Baird, somebody once said to him, so John Logie Baird, this great invention you've made, the television, what a wonderful invention. And John Logie Baird, typical Scotsman, said, aye, but there's fuck all on.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you, Jim. Also, I want to thank Glad Radio for having us here today, and The Deep End as well. It's a great setup here. Thank you very much for having us. Jim's podcast, Beyond the Cringe, should be out now if you're listening to this. So you can search it on all the usual podcast places. And thank you for tuning in. And bye.